Welcome to Virtual Economy, a podcast about the business of games for the rest of us. We're your hosts. I'm Amanda Farrow.
And I am Michael Footer.
Each episode, we'll cover the biggest business beats and bring an expert commentary from lawyers, analysts, and industry pros.
And you know, we were planning on having an industry pro on today, but we will have him on tomorrow because we are actually recording two back-to-back episodes. There is a heavy amount of news, so we figured we'd make this...
A twofer.
Make it manageable. So, today is episode 16.
Oh my goodness, we've done 16 episodes of this?
We have done...
No, we've done 17
episodes. We've done 17 because of episode zero.
We're the dumbest.
This is the best running joke ever. I'm going to get a t-shirt that says episode zero on it, and it's going to be amazing and no one will understand except you, and that's...
And that's okay.
That's all that matters.
All right, well, walk us through the first little bit of our news. We have a lot to get through today. We are talking about... a relief fund that the IGDA has set up. We're going to be walking through financials and inside Xbox, and we've got a lot to cover.
Absolutely.
So what do we got going on with the IGDA?
Starting with a piece of feel-good news, the IGDA Foundation is partnering with Take This, the Global Game Jam, and the Games and Online Harassment Hotline to create the Stay in the Game Relief Fund. These organizations have been hard hit due to event cancellations. Like, a lot of people and organizations have been hard hit. So starting, I believe this email went out yesterday, going through May 21st, the initiative is looking to raise $100,000. Now, they have secured $50,000 in matching funds from Riot Games, Devolver, Double Fine, Robot Teddy, Splash Damage, and Six to Start, among others. So matching funds, if you're not familiar with the concept, a corporation, an individual puts up a certain amount of money and says, if you can raise a dollar from the community, I will match that dollar up to this amount. So these groups together have combined and formed a pool of $50,000 in matching funds. Now, if the IGDA Foundation is part of the Stay in the Game Relief Fund can raise $50,000, they'll receive $50,000 in matching funds from these organizations. If they raise $45,000, they'll get $45,000. So that's how it works. So the best thing that can happen is they at least reach that $50,000 mark to make the most of those of that corporate generosity and then soar far beyond it. Now, the way this is going to work is that streamers are going to conduct charity streams to raise funds for the cause during the 2 weeks that it will be running.
That's great.
Yeah. And so a little bit about these organizations. Obviously, this caught our eye because we're big fans of Take This.
Yeah, absolutely.
But all three of these organizations are fantastic. And it's great because they all work to decrease stigma and support the mental health of gamers, of people in the industry. You and I have volunteered a lot for Take This. Mm-hmm. We've worked at the booth in the Diversity Lounge for PAX. We've taken advantage of the AFK room.
That is a lifesaver during E3 these years, where there are lots and lots and lots of people and bright lights and lots of sounds, and sometimes you just need to go and curl away at the AFK.
Absolutely. And Take This often does a number of panels at PAX. I've been on a Take This panel. We've been on panels with Take This representatives.
You bet. We're
huge fans of Dr. B and Eve. So if you are at all interested in contributing to these organizations, we'll drop a link in the show notes. But if you want it right now, it's GiveButter. I kid you not. GiveButter.com/stayinthegame.
I really hope that they raise a ton of money. I know that especially for members of the IGDA, which may or may not be small games studios and micro studios and independent game creators, they've all been hit really, really hard by this. And we've talked extensively about how this has hit the indie community, which is why we're continuing to, you know, do our indie spotlight whenever we have amazing folks drop into our inbox and say, hey.
Yeah. And tomorrow's episode with Zalvir Nelson Jr. is going to be one big indie spotlight.
It's going to be an enormous indie spotlight. All right, so let's jump into Microsoft's first Xbox Series X showcase. We had an Inside Xbox this morning, earlier today, and it was a big one.
Yeah,
it wasn't heavy on console details or anything like that. So there were some rumblings around that. Over on Twitter, folks were a little bit disappointed that it wasn't what they were looking for. But I think that it was a really strong lineup. And the best thing about it is that we got to see the impact of smart delivery.
Absolutely. So there are 10 new smart delivery games that were announced, and we knew that Assassin's Creed Valhalla was going to be using it because that popped up and we talked about that in the last episode.
Yeah, for sure.
But a couple of the others, Cyberpunk, we also knew was going to be one.
Yep.
Dirt 5 from Codemasters. Vampire the Masquerade Bloodlines 2 is going to use it, and you and I are both very excited. I know you are a longtime fan of the World of Darkness, of Vampire in particular.
Yes.
I've started Vampire the Masquerade Bloodlines 1 twice, and
it's a janky game. You gotta want it.
Right.
You gotta really want to get through the jank to get to the meaty, beautiful story.
And there is a fan patch out there that fixes some of the game's, we'll call them quirks.
Eccentricities.
I like that. the trailer today was really cool.
It was great. It was extremely vampire.
It was. Yakuza Like a Dragon. So the new game
coming. That
so
one's it's, big.
Yeah. So Yakuza, you know, now is fully a multi-platform game. For a long time, it was just on PlayStation. Yeah. Then it expanded to PC. Now Xbox players can enjoy that as well. So one of the things that jumped out to us from a business perspective was they were very upfront about a few things. There were logos, and we've started to see this over the past few years at E3.
Sure.
And some strange language around world exclusive premiere, console exclusive premiere. But they never say timed exclusive, but this actually had some logos that made things it really did. Easy. So there were a few. One was optimized for Series X.
Yes. And the vast majority of the games that we saw today on the Inside Xbox.
Enhanced for Series X, was it?
No, it was optimized.
Okay.
Optimized for Xbox Series X. You're absolutely right. We saw a number of games, the vast majority of the games, in fact, especially the really pretty ones, were optimized for Xbox Series X. That does not mean that they are exclusive to the Xbox Series X.
Right. So this... What's really interesting about this is because Microsoft is taking not only an ecosystem approach across console, across platforms, but within its own console family, so that the Xbox Series X is going to play Xbox One games. It's going to play Xbox 360 games. It's going to play OG Xbox games.
Wow.
So when you talk about something being optimized, and we saw that language this generation when you had games that were released, the OG Xbox games that were released on Game Pass, that actually had some Xbox One optimization in there as well.
They did.
So they were enhanced, I think is the language they use this gen.
Yeah. But optimized, I think, is a really smart way of finessing that language so that consumers are not necessarily like, oh my goodness, wait, I'm not getting the enhanced version? What do you mean I'm not? Do I have the lesser game? No, it's just... The game has been optimized for next generation. That doesn't mean that you're going to have a lesser experience on an Xbox One. It just means that it's not going to be necessarily as, I don't know, in your face, blow you away.
Right. And I think that what we're used to is purchasing a game and then potentially being able to take our save within the same console family. I'll use Destiny as mm-hmm. an example. Mm-hmm. Came out on Xbox 360 and Xbox One. Also mm-hmm. came out on PS3 and PS4. You know, you could play it on a last-gen console, but you weren't getting the best experience. I think we're going to see that again. I think the big difference this time around is smart delivery.
Smart delivery, man, I have talked so much about smart delivery. So if you want more information on that, we've talked about it a ton. What we will talk about, just to give you a quick recap, is that smart delivery is going to be the way that Microsoft will be allowing players that have purchased their games on the Xbox One, if they are smart delivery compatible, to be able to take those games and those saves to the Xbox Series X.
And here's why it's such a big deal to me. And I've been harping on this as well. You and I have talked about this a lot. For me, smart delivery is a streamlined, consumer-friendly way of respecting not just someone's time, but someone's purchasing dollar.
Absolutely. And considering that we're in the middle of a global pandemic where we're seeing unprecedented amounts of people losing their jobs and having to rely on unemployment, you know, luxuries like video games are not necessarily going to be at a long-term gain. Mm-hmm. And the Xbox Series X and the PlayStation 5 are coming out for the holiday season, which is usually the spendiest time of year for sure. But
who knows how many people are going to be back to work? Remember, we've had record unemployment here in the United States. More than 30 million people since the pandemic started have filed for unemployment.
And that's scary.
It is.
That is an extremely scary number. So not to put too fine of a point on it, the smart delivery is about creating a program that allows gaming for everyone. Mm-hmm. Which has been their ethos for the last handful of years, and it continues to promote Xbox as an ecosystem versus Xbox as a console.
And from the mechanical perspective, I think that it's really important to drive home how this is different than we've seen the limited cross-generational upgrade programs work in the past. This is seamless.
This is not an upgrade. That's not an upgrade program. This is an actual medium for delivering digital games.
It is a single SKU licensing program. Now, the reason why we emphasize single SKU is when you purchase a game on Steam or mm-hmm. on Epic Game Store or on GOG, you buy that game and you upgrade your PC hardware and you get a better version of that game. I upgraded my video card. I picked up a 2070 Super this year. And all of a sudden, all the games I had, I didn't have to repurchase a game. I didn't have to do anything else.
Exactly.
I already owned that game. Now, with the consoles, it's a little bit different because you have separate hard drives. You're going to need to re-download that game to your new hardware. But it will automatically know and optimize itself for the hardware that you have.
Exactly.
So you've... Let's say you pick up a game that comes out in October and mm-hmm. you're not done with it yet. You download and it has smart delivery. You download it in October. You play a bit on Xbox One. Xbox Series X comes out. That game is smart delivery enabled. You turn your console on day one. You tell it, yeah, download this game that I already own. Again, you're not repurchasing the game in the store.
You're
it's already
it.
In your library.
Yeah, you're just moving it forward. Just like Mike was saying, you know, I've been a PC gamer pretty much my whole life. And that was the one rub. That was one of the biggest rubs I had when it came to upgrading consoles, where it's just like, okay, well, my entire library is going to be for this former console. Like, what's my incentive as a broke student mm-hmm. to go ahead and upgrade? Again, the level of inclusivity with this just continues to blow me away. The important thing to note for smart delivery is that it will be available for all first-party Microsoft games.
Yes, just like Game Pass.
Exactly.
The other thing to note is that while Microsoft has said that it will not have any first-party exclusives for at least a year, potentially up to 2 years, mm-hmm. on Xbox Series X, meaning that all of its games will be enabled with smart delivery for the first year to 2 years, play on both Xbox One and Xbox Series X before that transition inevitably happens to only being playable on Xbox Series X. That is not the case necessarily for third-party. In fact, no. We saw during the presentation today that one of those games, Bloober Team's new game, Ooh. Medium... is an Xbox Series X, according to the press release that we received after. Yep. Xbox Series X and PC has not been announced for Xbox One or any PlayStation systems yet.
It's true.
That doesn't mean it won't happen in the future.
It does appear to be somewhat of an exclusive because especially if it's going to be available on PC, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to be on Steam. It could be available through Xbox Game Pass Ultimate.
Right. And I believe that one did have, there were one or two games in there that did have the Game Pass tag on them.
There was. And that's an interesting thing too, is that during the Inside Xbox, being able to have that taxonomy of, I can expect this particular third-party game to be available in Game Pass when it launches. Like, that's... Man, Game Pass.
Yeah. Bloober Team's last game, which was the Blair Witch game, also launched on Game Pass.
So it would not surprise me if the medium ended up on Game Pass as well. And especially if it's going to be available for PC, it'll end up on Game Pass Ultimate.
Yeah, I seem to recall that was one of the two maybe games that had the Game Pass tag.
That sounds about right.
We're going to talk about a little bit more about smart delivery and other options as we segue into our first hit of three. As when we start looking at some financials, we're going to start with EA.
We're looking at financials. We're doing it.
This is something that we had talked about doing. We think it's important to do a breakdown of important takeaways or key takeaways from financials. We're not going to cover every single company.
No.
We're not going to necessarily cover the same company every time.
It depends on whether or not there are some interesting story beats and what we can determine about how the insides of the company are working and quite frankly, if they're doing interesting stuff.
And I think what's what we have today is we have an interesting juxtaposition between EA and Activision. And we're going to start with EA, which closed its fiscal year on March 31st, 2020. So this is the reporting for its fourth quarter and its full year. One of the things that kind of stood out to me was obviously companies need to talk to their investors, need to talk to shareholders and analysts about what COVID is doing to the industry and doing to the companies themselves. EA had a very strong year. Its digital net bookings for the fiscal year were up 9% year over year, and they now represent 78% of total net bookings. So digital, 78% of EA's net bookings. But what is a net booking? It's time for Term Sheet. In this segment, we take a piece of industry jargon, put it in a blender, and make a smooth paste of easily digestible information. Yum.
There's nothing yummy about that. I'm going to make you rewrite that at some point, if I remember.
I'm going to put that on a t-shirt as well.
Gross.
And people will say, Mike, that t-shirt is disgusting. Where can I get one?
That's probably fair. So walk me through what net bookings actually are.
Okay. So there are three ways that we often talk about a company's money. The money that comes into them. And we have net bookings. We've got revenue, which is what people often think of. And we have collections. So bookings are when the money is committed to a company.
That's right.
Revenue is when the service is actually provided. So the gap that you have between bookings and revenue is often deferred revenue or unearned revenue. So it's a commitment. You've kind of gotten that money committed to you, but you haven't provided the service yet, so you can't fully recognize it.
Yeah.
And then collections is when the money actually hits your account. So if you hear net bookings, that's what that means and how it's slightly different from revenue. And EA actually defines its net bookings as the net amount of products and services sold digitally or sold in physically. So sold in, again, going back to sold in versus sold through, which has become less of a debate in the digital age. So sold in means when a company sells to a wholesaler or a retailer.
Mm-hmm.
Sold through means when it reaches its final destination in the hands of a consumer. So EA says that its net bookings are the net amount of products and services sold digitally because those are fairly instantaneous with a slight lag for when they get the money from the platform holder, yep. Plus sold in physically. It's calculated by adding the total net revenue to the change in deferred net revenue for online-enabled games and mobile platform fees. That's a whole lot just to say that if you hear net bookings, don't immediately think revenue. Just understand there is a slight difference between them.
It's a slight difference, but it's also really important because it's not money they can actually recognize yet.
Correct. And it's certainly not money that they have in their account. So again, that chain goes from bookings to revenue to collections when it actually shows up in the bank account. The other thing that really jumped out at me when I was looking through EA's financials is that they repurchased 2.7 million shares during their fourth quarter, which brought their total repurchases to 12.3 million shares for a total spend of $1.2 billion this fiscal year.
That's pretty spendy for share repurchasing.
It is. And we are going to talk about, once we get through Activision, we're going to chat a little bit about this because there's some challenging emotions around this. And I think that, you know, we're a business podcast and that doesn't mean we're completely divorced from emotions, but I think it's important to acknowledge some of what's happened over the past, you know, couple of years.
But we are about providing context, and this is important context.
Yep.
It may not be dripping in emotion like it was, you know, 2 years ago, a year ago. My goodness, it was only a year ago. But we do need to talk about it a little bit later on in the podcast.
But let's talk a little bit about share repurchasing, why it happens, and the impact that it has. So typically investors look very fondly upon share repurchases.
Of course they do.
It means that the company has money to spend, and rather than invest externally, it invests in itself. So it takes outstanding shares of its stock that are on the market and it purchases them. They can also tender an offer to their stockholders and say, hey, we'll buy this back from you at this fixed price, which is typically at a slight premium so that people are incentivized to part
somewhat with their shares. Incentivized for sure, because The flip side of that is that it increases dividends for shareholders as a result.
Absolutely, because you have fewer shares that are in the market. Each share then becomes worth a larger piece of the company. It becomes
more valuable.
And share repurchases tend to influence key metrics, notably earnings per share. But what jumped out at me, and the reason why we're talking about this, at the end of full year 2019, so that's as of March 31st, 2019, last fiscal year, earnings per share were $3.36 per share for the year.
Oof.
At the end of fiscal year 2020, so as of March 31st, 2020, $10.37 per share. Wow. That is a huge jump in earnings per share.
That's an enormous jump. And there are reasons why this happened that go beyond just repurchasing shares.
Yeah.
And we'll talk about that a little bit later, but it is a solemn reminder of the human cost.
Exactly. Digital was up, and we've been talking about that literally for the length of most of the length of my career as early as digital became
digital.
But one of the things, so it was up about 16% for EA. That's representative of about $600 million for the fiscal year. But the physical sales of full products only declined slightly. Now it's already significantly lower, but the fact that what we're seeing is a growing of the pie, as it is, as opposed to necessarily a shift in the size of the slices. Q4, so the final quarter of EA's year, was very service heavy, according to the company. Madden Ultimate Team had its best year yet. Apex Legends was the most downloaded free-to-play game on PS4 in 2019.
We have it on three of our PS4s here.
We do. We do. And I have it on my account. Grace has it on her account. Do you have it on your account?
I sure do.
Oh, there you go. So, yeah, so we're part of the problem.
We are definitely part of the problem.
Or as EA would say, the moochers who aren't buying anything on it.
Meh.
We are not whales.
No.
All right. So the other thing that stood out to me is, obviously, as I mentioned, every publicly traded company needs to be upfront with its investors and is often encouraged to do so that there is no blindside that happens at the end of the year or the end of a quarter. So they talked a lot about the impact from COVID-19.
Yeah.
So these are some quotes from the earnings statement. With more people staying at home, we've experienced and are continuing to experience heightened levels of engagement in live services, net bookings, growth to date. Ah, net bookings, see?
Ah-ha-ha! We've come full circle.
We have. The full extent of the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic to our business, operations, and financial results will depend on numerous evolving factors that we are not able to predict. The key risks to EA's businesses are set forth under the heading forward-looking statements in this release, which I scrolled down to.
That's impressive. I'm really glad that you scrolled. Also, before you jump into the forward-looking release, this also touches on the conversation that we had with Matt Piscitella, where it is almost impossible for analysts, let alone internal economists at these various large corporations, to determine what their guidance should be for the next quarter, let alone the next fiscal year.
Absolutely. Now, the important thing to know about forward-looking statements in an earnings release is that they are worst-case scenario. They are written to cover the butt, as it were.
Mm-hmm. And it's a big butt to cover.
It is. Now remember, EA is a very sports-heavy business.
Yes.
And FIFA Ultimate Team, Madden Ultimate Team, those bring in a ton of money for the company. Their mobile games bring in a ton of money for their company. So
Damn net bookings, though.
So as some of the things that might disrupt EA's plans and its outlook, continued disruptions, postponements, or cancellations of sports seasons and sporting events around which the company seeks to launch games and provide live services. So if football doesn't happen this year, that's going to make things weird for a new Madden game, which we know, based on Inside Xbox, is absolutely coming this year.
It is 100%.
Not that anybody's surprised, right?
100% honest. Yeah. Everyone was like, is there going to be a new Madden? Of course there's going to be a new Madden. There's always a new Madden.
Yep.
In rain or shine, there is Madden.
And my understanding is the show, the MLB game from that Sony puts out, is doing relatively well. So it doesn't mean, it's not doom and gloom.
No, certainly not. And it's not to say that these games aren't going to come out. It's just going to be kind of strange.
Yeah. The question is, how do you do player ratings when nobody can...
Are you talking sports ball again?
I am talking sports
ball. I'm sorry, again. I only speak sports puck.
Oh, I know. All right. So the closure of several of the company's key locations, including its global headquarters in Redwood City, which and key studios across North America, Europe, and Asia, which could impact, one, the company's ability to meet product and live service development schedules and the effectiveness of the company's quality controls and game testing measures, and the company's ability to conduct normal business operations. So, essentially, what we have is a laundry list of, here are all the ways, and there's even more here.
There is. It's a lengthy statement.
It is. And it touches on all the different partnerships, retail partners, closures of physical stores, delays in the release date, and decreased unit volume of next-generation consoles, something you and I have talked about quite a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Volatility
in... And we'll get to it again when we talk about Nintendo.
We will. Volatility in foreign currency exchange rates, other risks related to the COVID-19 pandemic that may be unforeseen as of the date of this release. So essentially what they're saying is COVID is messing things up and we don't know how bad it's going to get and how much it's going to mess things up. So we're just letting you know that, you know, as much as we expect things to be okay, you know, there's stuff that's out of our hands. And that's typically what forward-looking statements are meant to address. So narratively, there were a couple of things to take away. Star Wars Jedi Fallen Order, you and I talked about this back when we were, when you were editor-in-chief at Game Daily and I was mm-hmm. writing for you. This was kind of EA's chance to prove out that, you know, there was a place for single-player games that have no multiplayer, no microtransactions, no DLC.
No DLC. That's the big one. The big one is no DLC.
Yep. There was a free update that just came out on Star Wars Day on May the 4th. So that it added
that's a good marketing opportunity.
It is, exactly. So 10 million players. So that is inclusive.
That's solid.
It is. It's really solid. So that's inclusive of anybody who purchased the game and anybody who played it as part of Xbox or EA Origin Premier.
Right, because this is not available on any other subscription service. It's only on EA's.
Yep, and that's just on PC.
And just on PC, that's right.
So it hasn't hit the vault yet. Mm-mm.
For EA Access. EA Access on consoles, which only just came to consoles last year. Or came to PlayStation.
Came to PlayStation last year. It was on it's been on Xbox for years, but Sony finally said, okay, fine.
Yeah, I wrote a big story about that
you
last
sure
year.
You sure did. EA also finally getting off the stick for Switch.
Only took them 3 years.
I don't understand what took so long, quite frankly. But there will be multiple EA games coming to Switch this year. The first one that we knew about coming this year has already been announced, and that's Burnout Paradise Remastered.
Aw, yeah. Burnout Paradise is going to be awesome.
Now, here is the big thing that jumped out at me. Now, we talked about smart delivery when we talked about Inside Xbox and Xbox Series X. During the Madden segment, it was announced that there would be an upgrade program. They did not use the term smart delivery. I think there was some assumption that needed to be corrected in some quarters that it was going to be smart delivery. It's not.
No, EA is not using smart delivery. It's opting for its own limited time upgrade program instead. Remember how we talked about how these upgrade programs are super cumbersome and not super consumer friendly?
Yep, here we go again. Now, EA, my hope is that this will change should Sony move off the dime and say, okay, we're going to do a smart delivery thing too, but not call it smart delivery.
Because smart delivery, let's be real, is not a great name.
We're going to call it PlayStation Zoom Zoom.
Ooh, I like PlayStation Zoom
PS
Zoom, though.
PS Zoom Zoom.
That's good.
That's
good.
That's terrible.
That's really bad.
PS Zoom Zoom.
No, you're not Mazda.
But if they put the PS in front of it, it's like, also Zoom Zoom.
Terrible.
Yep.
Right into the sun.
So EA isn't taking sides, I guess, because they've also announced that they are going to have some kind of upgrade program on PlayStation 5 as well.
But it's time limited.
It is.
It's time limited. And so what they're going to be doing is it's only for a limited time for players that purchase within a window, and then it's only available for a limited number of time. Mm-hmm. So if you purchase Madden NFL 21 on Xbox One, by December 31st of this year.
So 2020.
You have 3 months to upgrade it to Xbox Series X. So if you don't upgrade Madden NFL 21 by March 31st, 2021, you're not getting that upgrade.
I'm going to be honest. I don't understand when... I can probably understand from them mitigating some financial hit from not getting that re-up that double dip. But here's the thing. When you're announcing that Madden Ultimate Team has done so well, why are you throwing the barrier up? Why are you telling people?
Why are you splitting your fan base?
Exactly. And also, there's the question now that I have. Okay, if these are two separate SKUs, this is not a single SKU upgrade program.
No, it is not.
It is two different SKUs. Are you carrying people's accounts forward? Are you carrying their progress forward? Are you carrying their Ultimate Team collection forward? And if the answer is not yes, you're throwing yet another barrier up. EA, why are you not using smart delivery?
You're leaving so much money on the table. That is a potential for not just consumer satisfaction, but it's to get people to be like, oh, shoot, I don't have to spend this extra money on the Series X upgrade. I'm just going to spend this on Ultimate Team if that's the case. And that's microtransactions and DLC money that they wouldn't have seen otherwise.
And honestly, look, every smart delivery game that's announced is a feather in Microsoft's cap. I can't speak to any negotiations or conversations that have happened in the past, but if EA isn't on the phone with Microsoft saying, hey, this is huge for you, if we announce that all of our games are coming to smart delivery, including our sports games, you want people
to...
A marketing deal, and EA would be well within their rights to turn around to Microsoft and say, we'll do it. But this is part of a marketing promo. So yeah, if you want
this is cross-promotional.
Exactly. And if that conversation isn't happening, it's bad for consumers, it's bad for EA, it's bad for Microsoft. And again, I can't speak to whether that conversation has been had. I can't speak to the terms that EA would have been asking Microsoft. But the fact is, I look at this and I'm like, this is not great.
It's myopic.
Let's
be real. It's myopic and it is prioritizing short-term gains over long-term. Like we talked about this. We talked about user acquisition. Have we talked about user acquisition yet? We might not have. But I know I have talked about user acquisition in the past.
We have it. We'll be talking about it a little when we talk about Activision's.
That's fine. Stuff. But let's just dip into it just a little bit right now. Mm-hmm. So user acquisition is really important, right? And part of user acquisition is like dangling that carrot in front of a user's face and being like, all right, come on in. You can come in now. Come on, this way. Come and do the thing. Then they do the thing. Then you got to keep them.
Yeah.
Right? But if the carrot in this particular instance is just, okay, well, I have a limited time to upgrade to Series X. I don't have the money to upgrade to Series X.
Or I can't find one because supply is going to be so constrained. I feel like...
It's just so short-sighted.
It is very short-sighted. EA, I hope you revisit this. I think this is not a great option. And in absence of smart delivery, in absence of that technology... Okay, you're offering something, and therefore you're doing something rather than nothing.
But
the options there,
you're creating more friggin' work for yourself.
Yeah,
make it easy, man.
Look, I'm sure you've got. I'm sure the reasons are there. I'd love to find out what those are.
In fact, if you are listening, someone that works at EA and makes these kinds of decisions, you can always email us. We're podcast@fsquared.biz, or you can send us a DM. You can also talk to us anonymously.
Absolutely,
you can hit us up on Signal. So that's also an option.
Yeah. The last thing I want to talk about at EA, and again, this is going to be an interesting point of juxtaposition. EA has said that it has 14 games planned for fiscal year 2021. It has four sports games, FIFA, NHL, Madden. And I think I saw there was a teaser for a new PGA game.
Really?
Yeah. So they might be doing golf. Back to golf, baby.
I love PGA games.
There you go.
I could talk about that sports ball.
Cool. That is a tiny little sports
ball. It is a tiny sports ball, but I prefer that sports ball to... other sports balls. Yep.
There are two new mobile games coming. There are four games from EA's existing IP, including Command & Conquer Remastered due in June. There's a number of EA Partners / EA Originals games coming.
Mm-hmm.
There's a new Sims expansion pack coming in June that deals with sustainable living. So
I love that.
Yeah. And then Apex Legends mobile and PC still in the works for Asia.
That's going to be a huge market for them to tap into.
Mobile especially.
Yeah, absolutely. China's going to be... It's going to be the big clincher, though.
Yep.
Just like it always is.
So that was EA fourth quarter and full year fiscal 2020. So there was a lot there, a lot to digest. Let's jump in to chief rival, Activision. Activision's fiscal year is on the calendar year. So they start their year on January 1. They end their year on December 31st. So on March 31st, they closed their Q1. First quarter. Right. They've closed Q1. Net revenue was a little bit down. Sales were down, but their subscriptions and live services were up, just not quite enough to compensate. But there's a reason why their sales are down. It's because they don't have a lot of games. And we're going to talk about that a little bit later.
They really don't.
You know, Activision's response to COVID, Bobby Kotick on, I think this was in the press release for the earnings, said we're covering all costs of testing and treatment for affected employees and their families. We've increased access to telehealth resources and contracted private doctors and medical support in regions where our employees live and work.
Actually, that's really cool. It that's is. Like surprisingly cool of
yeah.
them.
We are continuing to find other ways to support our employees and the and their families as we navigate through this unprecedented situation, including services to help families balance work and home life. And again, they had some forward-looking stuff in their earnings. Again, it's all the same these companies kind do. Of thing. But there is one that jumps out at us. We'll talk about that a little bit later. So let's break down Activision real quick. Call of Duty.
All right. So Call of Duty, this was a big year for them.
Yeah.
Warzone is boasting 60 million players.
Now, Warzone is their free-to-play yes. companion tie-in to Modern Warfare that is a Battle Royale.
That's right. It's their Battle Royale expansion-adjacent thing.
Right.
It's and, its own thing. It genuinely is.
You can
is.
Play it without owning Modern Warfare. Correct. And that's important because we'll talk about that a little bit later. Well, actually, we'll talk about that right now. So sell-through and players for Modern Warfare highest of any Call of Duty game.
I think that, honestly, Warzone has a lot to do with that.
It does. In fact, they said that. Ooh. Warzone is converting people, in a large number of people, to purchase the full Modern Warfare game. So that's really interesting.
And that's also something that you see with a number of free-to-play games, if there's a subscription option. So mm-hmm. we'll see that, especially within MMOs. Mm-hmm. So if you have the option to subscribe, like let's say Star Wars The Old Republic, yep. if you have the option to subscribe after you play for 10 levels, you're probably going to subscribe if you enjoy it.
Mm-hmm.
What this is doing is because Warzone is, you know, a really quick way to get into Call of Duty Modern Warfare and into their systems. It's a great way to get people to go, oh, is there more to this? Can I play the full... Oh.
Or maybe I just want to play a standard deathmatch or control point.
True. Or... Sure. Like, if they're just looking for a multiplayer experience, I mm-hmm. suppose.
Or they want to... It's like, oh, I remember liking Modern Warfare.
I don't remember liking Modern Warfare, but I'm sort of standing alone on that one. It's okay.
well...
It's okay. Call of Duty has not been my kind of game since, like, 2000.
I haven't played the last couple of years, but for a while there, like, I played it every year as my popcorn game. I'm gonna shoot stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. I look forward to Assassin's Creed for my popcorn game.
Well, that's fair. There is a new Call of Duty game coming this fall. We know you're shocked.
Really?
Yeah.
What kind of Call of Duty game is it? Do we know yet?
I think there's rumors that it's a remake of, what's it called? Black Ops. The original Black Ops.
Blops?
Blops. But that was the cool one. That one had a great story. It was like Cold War and what are the numbers? What do the numbers mean? What's in the box?
We talk a lot about what the numbers mean, Mike. We do. So maybe we'll have to play that.
So there was an interview with GamerGen about Call of Duty in general. There are a couple notes that popped out of that because one of the big questions that I have had about Activision's approach to Battle Royale is that it's tied to one game in the series. And if you look at Fortnite, if you look at Apex, those games live on their own. They can just continue to evolve and they keep their player base from one year to the next. There's no like, oh, you have to go and buy this new full product. Now with Warzone, you don't. But
no, you don't. It stands alone on its own. But again, how many people are going to be like, oh, well, I'm going to go play this new version. If it turns out that there is a new version, if they do it again for the next Call of Duty, they have their own free-to-play mm-hmm. offshoot. Which I can't imagine they won't. Maybe it won't be Battle Royale,
well,
but...
I think... Now, what's really interesting, and this is the big rub here...
Okay.
That my understanding is that Warzone progression is tied to multiplayer progression in Modern Warfare. So if you progress in Warzone, it actually helps your multiplayer progression.
Oh, so it helps with things like deathmatch and control point and stuff like
exactly.
that.
Exactly. So you can unlock new classes, unlock new perks, unlock new weapons.
I didn't know
that. Now, what I've always wondered about this is if you have that strong tie to a retail product that's annualized, how do you keep people and how do you keep them invested? Now, there was an interview on GamerGen with a couple of people, Taylor Kurosaki, who is the studio narrative director at Infinity Ward, who said, Warzone will be the through line that connects all of the different various sub-franchises of Call of Duty. It's going to be really cool to see how the different sub-franchises sort of come in and out of focus. But Warzone will be the one constant.
Interesting.
And then Amos Hodge, who's creative director at Raven, which also works on Call of Duty and Warzone. Warzone is like its own product, so we want to support it like a full product with new game modes and updates. So my question is, are they going to do something to sever that link a little bit so that Warzone continues to live on its own, like Fortnite, like Apex, and, you know, really takes its, you know, kind of plants its feet as its own product and isn't necessarily dependent on the annual Call of Duty game?
I mean, unless they sever that connection, like if they sever that connection, which I think is reasonable to say they probably will, are they going to reconnect it to, are they just going to continue to connect it to whichever Call of Duty game is going to be upcoming? Because if they're feeding into each other, I can see how that is really symbiotic. If they don't, then it's going to have to live on its own and be completely disconnected from all of the different Call of Duty games, yeah. The standalone Call of Duty games.
Now, what was interesting to me, before we wrap up Activision, we have a few more things left to do, is that they sold the Call of Duty Modern Warfare 2 campaign as its own thing. Wouldn't it be interesting if Call of Duty becomes Warzone and the single player content is sold as add-ons to this living thing? You have this complete paradigm shift.
I mean, I don't play Call of Duty anyway, but that, like, oh, I don't know. That's very, oh, that's very Battlefront-y. And that was not an okay thing for me personally. Mm-hmm. Especially, like, I mean, I know that they're different companies and they're different studios and these are different IPs and whatever. But I remember when the game was announced and I was like, oh man, I'm totally going to play so much Battlefront. I'm so excited for the story because I've played the other Battlefront games.
Yeah.
That didn't happen for me. I haven't played Battlefront 2 yet, so, you know, like, no spoilers, but I'm looking forward to that eventually. Mm-hmm. But still, like, I love the single-player content. The single-player content, the story content, I don't care if it's co-op or not, but give me story, man. I'm so old. I can't keep up with the kids and the multiplayers.
So I think what's interesting is we may be seeing a paradigm shift in how these games are sold.
Perhaps, yes.
Speaking of selling games, Activision Publishing, which is, remember, part of the larger Activision Blizzard company,
yes,
has only two more games scheduled for this year, and they're based on library IP. So
Activision, what do you mean by library IP?
So now? Catalog, so like Spyro, like Crash Team Racing or the Crash Insane trilogy. You know, they're going to be, that doesn't necessarily mean they're going to be remakes, but it means they're going to be looking at existing IP. Now, could they re-release a Skylanders collection that doesn't require the toys? That might be interesting. Those were great ARPGs.
That could be really cool. I could, like, hook our kids in. That's absolutely for sure. The littlest ones have never played a Skylanders game before. They've only ever played LEGO Dimensions.
Aha! All right, moving on from Activision to Blizzard.
Okay, so Blizzard is more my neck of the woods. So the big takeaways from what's going on at Blizzard is that we are seeing increased usership over at World of Warcraft. This is including new and returning players. We're seeing this for what's the reason? What is it? Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah, pandemic. The pandemic. We're stuck at home.
We're stuck at home. I mean, I'm currently playing two MMOs right now.
Wait.
A little bit.
What's the second one?
Guild Wars.
Oh! When did you start that?
I haven't technically started it yet, but I did install it.
Oh, I see.
I'm thinking.
So you're on Mikey time.
I'm on Mikey time on that one.
You'll be there.
I will. I will do
My island's open. When are you coming? I don't know. Maybe sometime.
We're not talking about Animal Crossing yet. We will get there. So, WoW is seeing some increased usership, obviously, because we are in the middle of a pandemic and playing something like, playing an MMO of any kind, and we can attest to this as frequent Final Fantasy XIV players. You know, it's really important for socialization, for continuing to have those ties to your friends, even if you can't see them on a regular basis. Something else to consider is that this isn't just about WoW either. Mm-hmm. It's all of Blizzard's games. So we're talking about Overwatch. We're looking at Hearthstone. I think that Heroes of the Storm still exists. It does.
I think they might have even released a new hero.
A new hero. I think you're probably right. This is so strange.
It is, because they spun everything down. That's a completely different conversation.
I don't have enough. No, I refuse. So anyway, all of Blizzard's games have seen an increase in month-on-month usership because of the pandemic. There's going to be a new World of Warcraft expansion this fall. We weren't given any details about what it is yet.
No, we do actually have some details. It's called Shadowlands.
Wait a second. Like Shadowbringers?
I don't know. Join a covenant, siege an eternal prison, save lost souls, and all of reality.
Cool.
Yeah, it was announced at BlizzCon.
Oh, that's right. I forgot about that. I didn't really pay attention to BlizzCon.
It's hopefully, my understanding, because I've never played WoW, Final Fantasy XIV is not my first MMO, but it's the first one I've severely invested in. But my understanding is that people didn't love Battle for Azeroth. Or wait, is Battle for Azeroth was the last expansion?
Yeah, right? That's right. So Battle for Azeroth did some weird stuff with the story that a lot of people didn't really care for.
Yep. Shadowlands would be the 8th expansion pack coming in that the game has had.
My word. Okay, so quick story time. I played World of Warcraft when it first came out in 2004. Vanilla? I played vanilla World of Warcraft. I played the first expansion, and then I dropped off the face of the earth. I picked it up for the most recent expansion for a little while, but man, it just doesn't grab me the way that Final Fantasy XIV does. But let's get away from WoW. Let's talk about Diablo.
But not the Diablo you want.
Don't you have a mobile phone?
Oh, boy.
Okay, so dumbass memes aside, Diablo Immortal is going to be starting regional testing later this year.
And that is a partnership with NetEase, correct?
That is a partnership with NetEase. So that's their mobile Diablo game that people are not so thrilled about. That's going to potentially hook in players in Asia. So that's not just China. We're also talking about Southeast Asia and India.
But they also, to be clear and put a fine point on it, this is regional testing. So they didn't even commit to a full global release.
This is testing. So we are going into probably closed alpha.
So Canada, New Zealand.
The usual suspects.
Yeah, so it's the soft launch.
It'll be the soft launch this year. And that's later this year. That's not even like this summer or whatever.
They just said later this year.
Later this year. Suspiciously.
I control F this thing when I was looking at the transcript.
Suspiciously, there is no mention of Diablo 4.
Yeah.
So we are, it's been announced. We've seen it. It looks glorious. It looks gorgeous. I am such a huge Diablo fan. I've been playing Diablo pretty much my whole life. Mm-hmm. So I want this game so badly, but I know I'm not going to see it this year. Yeah. And I probably won't see it next year either.
Really?
But,
well,
who's the ringer? Who's our ringer at Diablo? Who is the man that ships?
Oh, Rod Ferguson joined the Diablo team. I forgot about that.
Yes. So Rod Ferguson joined the Diablo team. I think it was even this year.
Time is
a flat circle and a social construct, and it doesn't matter. But Rod Ferguson, the man who ships.
Yep, he's a closer.
He is the closer of all closers in the game industry. He has joined the Diablo team. So if we don't see it this year, I suspect we will likely see it for BlizzCon next year.
Yeah. It's
It's a rough time to be a Diablo fan.
All right. So real quickly, King, which is the company that makes Candy Crush, usership is up. He had a big spike in March. I wonder why.
Shocking.
Yeah. The big thing that I took away from the King section of the earnings is that they're advertising net bookings. So people who advertise with King to promote themselves within Candy Crush and King's other games, they had a 75% jump in net bookings.
That's bananas.
Year over year. And the reason why that's really interesting is because there's a huge drop in digital advertising across the sector.
So it's really interesting that specifically with regards to King's advertising net bookings, that they went up so far. So likely what King is doing is it's capitalizing on those short-term gains because they are not going to be able to keep that.
They aren't. And they know that. So real quickly, I just want to point out a couple of things from their from Activision Blizzard's forward-looking statements. Obviously, potential for significant short and long-term global unemployment, economic weakness, and a resulting impact on global discretionary spending. We've talked about that a lot. As the pandemic continues, as people are out of work, it's going to negatively impact discretionary spending.
Yeah.
We know that it has an impact on companies' ability to release games and other content on time.
Yep.
The thing that jumped out at me is they actually acknowledged that one of their major potential weaknesses that they have a concentration of revenue among a small number of franchises.
It is minuscule.
It is.
It's minuscule in comparison to EA, to Ubisoft. We're even talking about, it is minuscule in comparison to Devolver, Raw Fury, Fellow Traveler, all
literally
of the major
anybody.
Indie publishers.
Now, I remember sitting at E3, sitting in an interview with Eric Hirschberg when he was the head of Activision Publishing, and there were four banners on the wall. And it was back when Guitar Hero Live was still running, so that was one of them. Then there was
Those
Call of Duty.
Days.
There was Destiny, and there was Skylanders. And when I looked at Activision back then, and when I reported on Activision back then, I compared them to other companies by saying, like, Activision typically is a sniper, while everybody else tends to be a shotgun.
Right.
And I was pretty happy with that analogy. Now, again, this is back when Activision also had some other little projects. It had its licensed game business. It had a business office in Minneapolis that handled that. Mm-hmm. That is since gone. You know, again, we're not, even Blizzard right now isn't releasing very much.
No.
But here's the thing.
It's because Blizzard's not making very much.
Activision as a company, yes, Call of Duty is big. Regardless of what you think about it, it brings in the numbers, it brings in the players, people are happy with it. The vocal minority on social media does not represent the way the game actually sells. But Activision as a company right now has become less and less interesting for me over time, because it just isn't doing much.
It's not doing...
It's doing Call of Duty.
Exactly.
It's doing a couple of mobile games like King. I recognize these are big money makers. They're not the kinds of games I play. They're interesting from an analytical perspective, like looking at the advertising net bookings. Okay, great. Blizzard, love what you do. And I know that a lot of your games are running on, you know, their service games, and you've got updates. You got updates to Hearthstone and, you know, et cetera.
Overwatch, everything like that, for sure.
But we know Overwatch 2 is coming. Overwatch 2, I don't believe, was mentioned in that transcript either.
Sure was not.
So, you know, Activision publishing specifically has become relatively uninteresting.
It's boring.
It's the Call of Duty machine, and that's all it is. And then, you know, look, the Spyro trilogy remastered was great.
Was so good.
People who love Crash Bandicoot were really happy with the Insane trilogy and Crash Team Racing. Okay, that's great, but you're not innovating. You're not really bringing me anything that's interesting. And yeah,
you're not bringing me a Skylanders. You're not bringing me a Guitar Hero.
And I look at you, and I look at both Blizzard and Activision Publishing and King, and I look, you're missing a huge piece of the market. There is an audience problem for Activision Blizzard that I think they need to address. You had fixes for it with Guitar Hero and with Skylanders. Where is the rest of your audience? You've got your bro dudes with Call of Duty.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, that's not to slam Call of Duty at all. I mean,
no, but it serves a very specific audience.
It does serve a really specific audience. I am not that audience anymore. I haven't been that audience in 17 years. Wow. I haven't played a Call of Duty game since I was 16. 17? Oh boy.
Was that Call of Duty 2?
It might have been. It was a long time ago. I like first-person shooters, but Call of Duty hasn't really been my game in a long time. Yeah.
I think the big takeaway from EA and Activision, and you and I talked about this before we started recording, is that people being at home is helping acquisition, especially for service games. People are getting in the door. It's saving them money on acquisition. Mm-hmm. But the big question is, how are you going to retain people who are dabbling in your games after a sense of normalcy returns?
So once sports comes mm-hmm. back to ESPN, and once you're able to go outside and see your friends and see your family, you know, like, how are you going to be able to maintain that user retention, you know, to keep those monthly active users up, the daily active users up? These are all important metrics for determining what content gets pushed and when. The other portion that we do need to address now is the human cost.
Yes.
And the human cost of all of this. Mike and I reported on both of these in large layoffs. You know, Activision's was enormous.
Yep, I wrote that for Variety. You wrote that for Game Daily. Then we drank a lot of wine because it was rough.
Wow. We drank a lot of wine that night. That was really, really, really hard. Good friends of mine, you know, that worked at Blizzard especially, lost their jobs in support and PR and comms and everything like that and marketing. It was a bad, bad week.
Yeah, it's February 12th of 2019. Activision Blizzard lays off nearly 800 amid major restructuring. So it ended up being, I updated the story, it was 775 people, 8% of its 96 per 100 person staff. Refocused its efforts on Call of Duty, Candy Crush, Overwatch, Warcraft, Hearthstone, and Diablo. Activision called the move a deprioritizing of initiatives that didn't meet expectations. Which is why you're not seeing the broad focus and the serving a more inclusive audience.
It's even the same thing at Blizzard. I mean, I spoke to Alan Adam back in 2018, I believe. Yeah. And he sat down with me and we talked about, you know, what his role in the company has become, because he was an original founder. He left, he came back. And when we talked about this, it was a, what do you do now? Oh, well, I help incubate ideas at Blizzard. That's my job now. And now that Blizzard has clearly moved away from, we're going to experiment in a number of different places. You know, they've got their, you know, they've got their collectible card game. They've got their
shooter.
They've got their shooter, their hero shooter.
Yeah.
You know, they've got their arena brawler, their MOBA equivalent, mm-hmm. and they've got their MMO, mm-hmm. and they've got their ARPG.
Yeah.
So we're not seeing anything else mm-hmm. because they already did the thing. So yeah. what's next? And like, that's the big issue, is that if Blizzard has been known for so many years for innovating, for setting gold standards in the industry with regards to content, with narrative, with cinematics, with gameplay, with the way that they handle their communities. They were one of the original explosive MMOs. Like, we're not looking at Ultima. We're not looking at, you know, like the MMOs of days past. This MMO has stood the test of time over the last 15 years.
Yeah.
This, it's just, it's rough. And the layoffs and the deprioritization is mm-hmm. what led Activision into painting itself into a corner.
Yeah. And then about 5 weeks later, EA laid off 350 out of 9,000 employees. Now, EA's handling of this was far more humane than Activision's. I think there was a legitimate criticism about Activision and the way it handled
because they called it layoff. A deprioritization yeah. instead of recognizing the very human cost of what they were looking to do, which, quite frankly, was an inflation in probably in management
mm-hmm.
that caused this problem to begin with, where they didn't know where they were going. So, of course, the folks that are not making the decisions ended up suffering. But let's talk about the share prices.
Right. So when you look at going, this goes back to EA repurchasing all of those shares. Look, I will be the first person to tell you that there is the double-sided problem with layoffs. And one is that there is the human cost. These are people. These are people who create the things that we love.
That create, support, help, perpetuate, mm-hmm. promote, whatever.
The flip side of that is there are times when layoffs are necessary. And in those moments, it is absolutely important to handle them with as much humanity and compassion as possible. I think Activision dropped the ball so severely last year that it was unconscionable. I think EA handled it much better. I think nothing takes the hurt away
from layoffs, from studio closures,
yep.
from any of it, because these are folks that have poured their lives, and we're talking about some people, especially at Blizzard, that have spent anywhere between, you know, 5 and 15 years at the company just to see their career at Blizzard completely wash away.
Mm-hmm.
And it's heartbreaking, and it's hard as journalists to be, you know, particularly objective in those moments, to be like, okay, well, I understand why they did this from a business perspective, and my heart is absolutely broken.
The challenging part of about layoffs for me is, you know, investors love them.
Oh, investors adore them.
Yep.
They love it because they're like, oh, there are fewer people for you to pay. Awesome, more money for us.
Yep. And then, you know, you see, you know, big stock, you know, repurchases and earnings per share go up.
Exactly.
So I think it's important for us to remember that when we're reporting on earnings, it's not a flash in the pan. It is a snapshot, but it is important for us. And this is our ethos as reporters, to get the full context and remember that there is a timeline of things that happen leading up to something, and there's a timeline of things that happen after it. And in some way, the layoffs of 2019 have paved the way for companies to do better now. And, you know, Activision, I mean, just hitting on Activision one more time, remember that the big cognitive dissonance that happened with that was they reported like a record quarter.
It was a record
and then
quarter.
And laid off that many people.
Almost 1,000 people.
Yep.
Like, we cannot state that enough. A record quarter and almost 1,000 people lost their jobs.
And that's the moment where you have to be compassionate and you need to take the time to explain, like, hey, obviously that's looking backwards, our quarter, and we need to look forward, and here's where we're seeing some weaknesses moving forward in our job. Remember, everything comes from the top.
Yep.
And my understanding in talking to people who work at EA is that Andrew, in particular Andrew Wilson, does take that stuff really seriously, and he, which is why the email that they sent out was compassionate. But you know, there was none of that on the Activision side.
It was cold-blooded. Yeah. It really was. It was a cold-blooded, ruthless approach. It was very Silicon Valley.
Yep.
As opposed to, you know, what we are expecting, what we have come to expect from game companies, which is not, we're a family. And a lot of these game companies are like that, where they, you know, yes, we can talk about the double-edged sword of, you know, the, oh, well, we're a family and therefore you should work infinite hours, that approach, another time.
Yeah, that manipulative stuff. All right, why don't you, because we're not going to end this on a downer.
No.
We're gonna go through Nintendo real quickly.
There's so much good stuff in Nintendo. Like, honestly, Nintendo continues to eat everybody's lunch.
And nom, here's, nom, nom.
Nom, nom. They've been eating everybody's lunch for, like, the last 2 years. It's kind of amazing. They came in, and everyone's like, what the heck is a Switch? And then it just completely took the world by storm. But let's specifically talk about what Nintendo has been up to. They reported their the end of their financial year for March 31st, 2020, and they reported their Q4 for fiscal year 19.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, look, see, I did it.
Which, because I think they name theirs based on the year that it starts, but companies in the West name their fiscal years or label their fiscal years
based on the year they end. So it's just confusing.
In the fiscal year that ended March 31st, 2020.
There, he did it. He did the thing. So, let's talk about some sales. Pokemon Sword and Shield came out in, what, November of last year?
Yes.
Since November of last year, Pokemon Sword and Shield have sold 17.37 million units.
That's combined across the two versions.
That is combined across the two versions. I mean, okay, I'm not going to go into the differences between Pokemon Sword and Shield. If you want to do that, superparent.com has the best breakdown and analysis of what goes into Sword and Shield and which Pokemon are in each. Seriously, that is an actual thing. Brandy is amazing. The big thing, though, let's talk about Animal... Oh, Mike, can we talk about Animal Crossing?
Yes, let's talk about Animal Crossing.
I love talking about Animal Crossing. I do it a lot across all of the various podcasts that I'm on. So Animal Crossing New Horizons has sold 13.41 million units over its first 6 weeks. Animal Crossing came out, what, second week of March?
Yep. I think it was around for, it came out the same day as Doom.
Yeah. Doom, yep, probably also did very well, yes, but we're never going to know because...
No, they announced it did well.
Oh, did they announce,
yes,
that?
They I think they shared those data.
Perfect.
That data. Now, that's the 6 weeks. Now, remember, the fiscal quarter and the end of the fiscal year only covered 2 weeks.
Only covered 2 weeks.
Now, of those 13.41 million. 41
million. 11.71 million were sold in the first 2 weeks. Holy muffins, Batman.
Yeah.
That's a lot of Animal Crossing.
It is the number 7 game. So it hit the top 10. So Nintendo's, I love Nintendo for doing this, by the way. They always update their top 10, their million sellers.
Mm-hmm.
So it is number 7 on the list now. Ahead of it are, and number 1 is Mario Kart 8 at 24.77 million units.
Mm-hmm.
So then Smash,
yep,
at 18.84. Breath of the Wild at 17.41. Super Mario Odyssey, also at 17.41. It's neck and neck. It's a tie for third place. Sword and Shield at, as you said, 17.37. And then Let's Go Pikachu and Let's Go Eevee at 11.97 million. And then creeping up on it and soon to surpass it because...
Animal Crossing.
11.77 million as of the end of March. But we already know, and I think it's safe to say, it has overtaken Pokemon Let's Go Pikachu and Pokemon Let's Go Eevee.
As much fun as they are,
they're now old enough that I'm pretty sure they did not sell another 2 million copies in the last 4 weeks.
No, people are going to be buying Pokemon Sword and Pokemon Shield.
So, Tom Nook has his eyeball on Pokemon.
Probably.
Sword and Shield.
He's a trash panda. He is a trash panda. And you know what? I don't have the time to talk about Tom Nook right now. So... Nintendo ended up talking about some of the effects of COVID and how it impacted their Q4 earnings. Production and shipments of the Switch, accessories like the Joy-Con controllers and Ring Fit Adventure faced delays in some regions from February through March, but Nintendo noted that it only had a marginal impact on business overall. It does appear that delays in production and shipping are gradually recovering, but can take another nosedive if things continue to get worse throughout the world, which it probably will.
So hopefully you will eventually be able to find Ring Fit Adventures again.
For less than $200 on eBay.
Scalpers can eat it.
Yeah, so I was the smart person, and I bought it on launch because it looked awesome. So this is the big thing, though. One of the big things that Nintendo talked about, and this is that cultural difference between how the West handles game development, how Japan specifically handles game development, is development schedules may be impacted due to the difference in development environments between working from home or working under quarantine and in the office. In particular, this is anticipated to be even more difficult to predict than within Japan, apparently with regards to their overseas affiliations as well. But it's already really difficult in Japan because of the way that they handle, you know, design documentation and the development process in general. More information on that can be found in episode 11, where we had a conversation with DMM Games, and most specifically with Tak Fuji. Mm-hmm. All right, so are you ready?
Are you ready? My body?
Is your body ready to talk about hardware sales? Because there were some serious hardware sales.
Do it!
All right, so hardware sales for the Nintendo Switch for this fiscal year totaled 21.03 million units, which was a 24% increase on a year-over-year basis. Mm-hmm. That's a lot more Switches sold, again.
Uh-huh.
And software sales are sitting at a solid 42.3% increase on a year-over-year basis, 168.72 million units. That's a lot of software.
Yeah.
That's probably a lot of Animal Crossings and a lot of Pokemons.
Sure.
I would imagine so.
Absolutely.
The big thing here is that Nintendo Switch Online helped bring overall digital sales to a 71.8% increase for their overall digital sales. Like, that is enormous.
Uh-huh. Yep.
Digital.
Well, and eShop sales. Again, you know, those drive people.
It does. I mean, they have their eShop sales regularly. I wish they'd make it more user-friendly.
Oh, yeah. The eShop needs an overhaul.
The eShop always...
You know...
Most storefronts need overhauls when it comes to user experience, but what do I know?
So, Nintendo is also in the mobile game now.
They
had a slight increase, 11.5% increase. We've also know that Animal Crossing on
Pocket Camp
has seen a knock-on bump.
That's how I know that it's you that's saying stuff.
So there's been a knock-on effect for Pocket Camp. People have been enjoying New Horizons, so they want to play on their phone a little bit more. So Pocket Camp actually saw a jump. But we know that, and we talked about this on episode 14, Nintendo Investor Value Act.
The
activist investor. You can tune into episode 14 for yet another term sheet. Yum.
Gross. You're so gross.
To learn a little bit more about them and how they're hopefully going to help Nintendo improve in some of the areas where it's weaker, mobile included.
And overall transmedia entertainment. A big thing, though, is the total net sales and the operating profit. So the total net sales for this year increased 7.4% year over year, and the operating profit saw a 35% increase year over
year. Just a huge year for Nintendo.
It was a really big year. It's just like I said, Nintendo is eating everybody's lunch.
Yeah.
It's such an accessible system. So let's look forward. They ended up highlighting, yes, COVID is likely to have significant impacts. There's no way around it. We can't predict it. Same kind of thing about, you know, that we saw with all of the other big publishers. They also highlighted, looking forward, that we're going to see expansion passes for Pokemon games. This is the first time this has ever happened in Pokemon history. Pokemon has never had an expansion pass. There will be Pokemon DLC that's going to be released in both in June and in the fall. Then there is the Xenoblade Definitive Edition, in addition to their various third-party titles that will be released throughout the year.
Yep, and while we know that Nintendo isn't doing a big direct in June like it would have if there was E3, we can expect that we'll see some stuff over the summer, and this fall is going to have a blitz of titles.
Once Nintendo is able to really wrangle this working under quarantine thing, remember that living spaces in Japan are very different than living spaces in the United States, right? They're for the most part, they're smaller by a lot. So having a dedicated office has got to be difficult. Anyway, working stuff aside, Nintendo is expecting to see for next year, for this upcoming fiscal year.
So April 1, 2020 through March 31, 2021.
Yes, exactly. They are expecting to see results in $11.3 billion US in net sales with an operating profit of $2.8 billion US, which is, you know, that's good.
Respectable.
That is respectable. That's the interesting thing about Nintendo is that they are being really conservative on their estimates for a good reason. Projections for Nintendo Switch sales, so this is console sales, including the Switch Lite, are going to take a dip. They're projecting that they are going to sell 19 million units within the next year.
And I think that's reasonable when you have Microsoft and Sony who are about to take the spotlight away from them a little bit.
And we'll get to that. Their projections are for software is also muted. You know, they sold 160 million units for this past financial or fiscal year. And next year, they're looking to sell 140 million units. The takeaway here is that Nintendo is going to have to get comfortable with taking more of a back seat because, like you said, Microsoft and Sony are gearing up for next gen. The Switch does have a leg up because of the portability and also because of the cost effectiveness of the Switch Lite. Mm-hmm. But they're going to need to step into 2021 with a revised Switch model if they want to keep those hardware sales going because they are now on the other side of that curve.
Absolutely. All right. We got one more piece of news before we sign off for now and start recording our second episode of the day. All right. So last one we're going to hit, Fortnite.
Yeah, Fortnite.
Epic has announced that Fortnite has 350 million registered users. Holy. Makes Call of Duty Warzone 60 million look pretty laughable.
Okay, but hear me out. Fortnite's also cute.
I know. I don't really
do concerts.
I am kidding. And that is what we're going to talk about.
Let's talk about the concerts.
3.2 billion hours have been spent in the game. So we talked about the Travis Scott concert in
that
Fortnite.
Was
we
attended so
it.
Cool.
It was super cool. I think when we talked about it, we knew that they had hit 12.3 million on the first night.
Mm-hmm.
Total attendees at the Travis Scott concert were 27 million, and the event was attended 45.8 million times. So there were people who came back and were like, I need to see that again.
I mean, I don't blame them.
No, it was very cool.
That was a really neat experience. I'm going to have to, like, sit upstairs and, like, be on the PlayStation because I'm not installing Fortnite on my computer again because it takes up too much space.
That's fair. So Epic has released for Fortnite a new zone called Party Royale. It's a combat-free meeting zone, which is kind of cool. Again, Fortnite becoming the Second Life that Second Life never was.
Oh, Second Life tried so hard, though.
I know, it did. So there's a concert tomorrow, Friday, May 8th at 9 p.m. Eastern, featuring Deadmau5.
Deadmau5.
Steve Aoki and Dylan Francis. It's an hour-long concert, 3 back-to-back sets.
Oh, man, that's going to be so much fun.
Yeah, you don't need to queue up in advance because it's happening in the Party Royale space, not in the Battle Royale space. It will be repeated, if you miss it, Saturday, May 9th, 2 to 3 p.m. Eastern. So what's interesting for us is that we talked extensively about Fortnite becoming more and more than a game. And this was in our GamesBeat Trends piece that we wrote and published in December. So you can check that out on GamesBeat. The link is in the show notes.
Additionally, this isn't the first time that you and I have talked about it. Even in that Trends piece, that wasn't the first time
we talked about it the year before. In our forward-looking Trends piece. It's like, so that was our victory lap.
It was. It kind of was. We gave each other some high fives and did some self-fiving and et cetera, et cetera. So anyway, holy crap, that was a really long episode. Thank you for staying with us. And also, we need indies.
We need indies. If you are an indie developer, we would love to spotlight your in development or recently released game. Just shoot us an email at podcast@fsquared.biz or drop us a DM at virtualeconcast on Twitter.
We got through it.
We did it.
We got through an hour and an hour and change of big financials, of talking about Inside Xbox. And
we covered a lot in an hour.
We did a lot.
We did. So we are going to be back with another episode tomorrow. That one is just going to be an interview with Xavier Nelson Jr., who is working on a number of games. He's worked on Hypnospace Outlaw. He is working on an airport for aliens currently run by dogs and is part of a recently announced horror anthology that will feature 10 games. But for now, That's it. Thank you so much for listening to the Virtual Economy Podcast. You can follow us on Twitter at Virtual Econcast. I am at Footerish, F-U-T-T-E-R-I-S-H.
And I'm at Amanda Farrow. You can subscribe to our RSS feed if this is your first time here. You can find us at Libsyn. So this is virtualeconomy.libsyn. That's LIBSYN.com/RSS. You can also listen to us on all major podcasting platforms. We're on places like Spotify and Apple Podcasts and Google Play and Stitcher and Podcast Addict, and we're basically everywhere and you can't escape
us. Just search Virtual Economy and you should find us. And if you can't, let us know and we'll figure out what's going on.
It's true. I might have to do some digital finagling on that one. But the most important thing that you can do for us is hit that subscribe button, because it signifies to the algorithm gods that we are in fact special and important. And it's not just because our moms tell us so.
That's right.
And please also review the show. Let us know what you think. If you have notes for us, if you have things that you'd like us to talk about, you know, let us know in the review. Let us know via email, via DM. Mike, where can people find us?
You can DM us again at Virtual Econcast on Twitter, or shoot us an email at podcast@fsquared.biz. And as I said, we will be back tomorrow with our interview with Xavier Nelson Jr. In the meantime, wash your hands, stay hydrated, and be good to one another.
We'll see you tomorrow.